On this episode of the Fanboy Garage, we have dinosaurs, Star Wars, and a special guest. We start by unpacking our thoughts on the Jurassic Park franchise, and then Rick Hsu of Batman on Film joins the show to try to get to the bottom of why Aaron doesn't think the world needs an Obi-Wan Kenobi movie. There's a lot to discuss, so let's open the garage and start unpacking Episode 6. And welcome to the Fanboy Garage. I'm Chris Lasanti, and of course, my co-host is Aaron Varola.
Hello, people. How we doing? What's up?
So we've spoken a lot in the last couple of episodes about franchises, and we did Star Wars for a couple of episodes, and we did Halloween in the last episode. So we're going to talk a little bit about another franchise in this episode, that being Jurassic Park. Or Jurassic World, or whatever the... I guess it's the Jurassic Park franchise, right?
Yeah. Yeah, Jurassic franchise.
The Jurassic franchise. The new movie, Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, is actually coming out this week as we record this show. And, you know, Jurassic Park is an interesting franchise because, for me, it's one of three, or at least three, major franchises, very successful franchises, where I've only seen the first movie and have not seen anything else. The other two being Transformers and Pirates of the Caribbean.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And I can say I've probably committed more time than I wish to admit to not only this franchise, but to Pirates of the Caribbean, having seen all of the movies. And I think at some capacity I've seen all of the Transformer movies, for better or worse. So, yeah, those things just don't seem to escape me for some reason. If I'm just lounging on the couch and, you know, it's a weekend full of wine bottles and some other alcoholic beverages, I won't hesitate to pop on one of those movies and let my brain go away.
Yeah.
Melt away into the ether. But if I were to rank those franchises that you just listed off, I would certainly hold the Jurassic Park or Jurassic franchise at the highest rank for sure. I've had a very, I'd say, intimate relationship with those movies. I certainly have a soft spot in them because I think for me it was, you know, it was back in what, 93?
Yeah, it's 25 years ago.
25 years ago, yeah. And I fell in love with the magic that Steven Spielberg sort of crafted and created and brought to the screen. And he really made me believe that, you know, dinosaurs exist. And you know, at that point, I was consuming all things Jurassic Park. I read the first book. I also read the second book, Lost World. So I was kind of excited to see where it was going to go. I can firmly say that Jurassic Park was definitely the best of the franchise, and I'm sure we'll get into this, but with Jurassic World, what is it, Fallen Kingdom coming out this week, I could say that the first Jurassic World movie was probably the closest to the original in terms of feel and vibe, and just it played on nostalgia, which is what we're all about.
Yeah, we love the nostalgia.
We love it. But I will say that I'm not necessarily excited about this movie coming out this week. I think this will be the first one that I will pass on. Now, I saw Jurassic World in the theaters. I brought my wife. We loved it. She said, oh my God, I know that there are other movies. I've just never seen them. So we went back and we watched the first one. She loved it. And then we started the second one and it just didn't feel like the first. So we kind of checked out and she never got a chance to see the other. Was it Lost World?
The Lost World, yeah. Jurassic
Park. No.
The Lost World was the second one.
And then, Lost World is the second one. Yeah. So we kind of checked out after that one. I forgot what the name of the third one
Jurassic
was.
Park 3. No, nothing fancy.
Yeah. Okay.
He just
okay.
Went. Yeah. So. Yeah, it's funny. I, you know, my reasons for not continuing with those three franchises in particular are all somewhat different. Like, the reason why I didn't follow through with the Transformers franchise was because I actually just didn't like the first movie. You know, I didn't like the story that they were telling. I just would have preferred the whole thing to be set in space, like just the Transformers, no humans, you know, like, so I was
what,
like,
Transformers, the movie?
Kind of like a live action version of Transformers, the movie. So that kind of would have been during. So it just was like, all right, whatever. Pirates of the Caribbean, I didn't dislike the first movie. But I just thought that it was really more of like a one man show. My enjoyment of that movie was really all about Johnny Depp just being awesome and sort of elevating average material, like, and just kind of taking it and carrying it on his back, and just, he just made that whole thing for me. So I guess figuring like, well, I didn't want to go back to that again because it's probably more of the same. With Jurassic Park, though, I love the first Jurassic Park. I mean, it's one of the great, you know, genre movies. It was a revolutionary movie. I mean, this is a movie that, you know, it was such an experience in the theater, you know, just seeing those dinosaurs, seeing that CGI, listening to the sounds. I mean, it was one of the first movies, or maybe even the first movie, to have like the big digital surround sound,
in the theaters
at the time, because we're talking 25 years ago now. And it was such an amazing theater experience, and it's such a great movie. But when I've never felt at any point that like I needed to get more of that story.
Right.
Like, you know, I felt like Jurassic Park is what it is. It's a self-contained story with a beginning, middle, and end, and it's a great story. But, like, at no point did I ever say, wow, man, I really, I have to go back to that. Like, I feel like it's such a singular experience for me that just watching the first one works.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. For me, the original Jurassic Park, and I kind of commented about this on Twitter, but I saw that movie four times, and I was like in sixth grade when that movie dropped out. I don't know how many lawns I had to cut to get the money to go to the movies, or who I don't. I honestly, because my parents are those kinds of like stingy parents where they're like, yeah, we'll give you your like, I forgot how much movies cost back then, but maybe $3.50 or $5 or whatever, and like that's all you're getting. So I don't know how I scrounged up all of that cash to see that movie four times. But I saw it with like a bunch of different friends each time I saw it. And yeah, I mean, you want to talk about a movie that captures your imagination and really makes it feel like, you know, the things that you used to see in history books have come alive and are, you know, people are interacting with those things on the screen in such a realistic manner. It blew me away. And, you know, when I look back on it, matter of fact, I was watching it last night. Again, that CGI still holds.
Oh, it's insane. Like, yeah.
It's so good.
It's scary, actually, how good it is.
Yeah. And the funny thing, I don't want to say funny thing, but I'd say like the smartest thing that Spielberg did in terms of his direction was, you know, I think up until this point, there had been movies using CGI to some degree, but the physics of those characters, like when I think it's the Dilophosaurus, I think it's like, I forgot it. It's like one of those brontosaurus looking things. When it gets up on its hind legs to reach for a higher branch, like the actors are like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Yep. And they're looking up at this thing, and then it like comes down and they all kind of like shake a little bit. And it's like, that's brilliant. It makes it feel like they're still there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like they're actually there. So it was really, you know, I love that movie. I really do. I can watch it at any time of the year, any time of the day. Like that movie is just a classic for me.
Yeah, and it's something that very easily could have just been cheesy, and you know what I mean? Like in the hands of anybody else, who knows what that movie could have been. Like there's a lot of room there for that to have just been like kind of a cheesy sort of mess. But it's just so, I mean, just everything. You talk about checking off all the boxes from a creative perspective, and just hitting on it, just about everything. I mean, that's a movie that hits on just about everything.
Right, right, yeah. But then, you know, as you kind of work your way through the franchise, it just felt like they hit, like, repeat. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
At various points of that – well, actually, the second movie is a little different because they're still – it's funny because it almost feels like Jurassic World doesn't recognize the other films, right? So they're not calling back to them like that. So in the second movie, and I don't know if you remember this at all, but it's basically about capturing the Tyrannosaurus Rex. And the Tyrannosaurus Rex had like a baby Rex.
Baby Rex.
And they're transporting it, and somehow it gets let loose in a city. And it's all because it wants to find its baby. And it's bad. I think he still produced. I think Spielberg still produced it. But
He directed the second
one.
It
is certainly, in my opinion, a failure. So, and really shows, you know, sort of the separation of like creativity and all of that versus the second movie. It's just they feel very different and very disconnected from one another, other than the fact that, again, they're going to get the same T-Rex essentially.
Yeah. I mean, not knowing much about the only things I know about the sequels, mm-hmm. at least the Lost World and Jurassic Park 3, is that I know that the book, The Lost World, was actually written after the original movie was a huge hit, and it was kind of written almost, it's very similar to Hannibal. Like, I know it's a very different franchise, but where, like, when The Silence of the Lambs became such a huge hit, like, Thomas Harris sort of begrudgingly actually wrote Hannibal because they wanted to make another movie and they wanted it to be based on, like, a book that he had written. So he wrote Hannibal, and then they made the movie. And it's kind of that deal, like, Spielberg basically gassed Michael Crichton, I believe, to just, can you write, like, a sequel?
Right.
And he wrote The Lost World, and then they wound up making the movie, which is kind of interesting. So, yeah, I didn't really know much about the plot. I do know that there aren't a lot of people that I know that have seen it that actually have very positive things to say about it. I actually know a few people that are more positive about Jurassic Park 3 for whatever reason than they are about The Lost World.
Yeah, that one's definitely better because let me remember that one. That one is they bring back Alan, the Sam Neill character. He's back, and they are – I think this is the right one.
Well, Sam Neill is definitely in Jurassic Park 3.
Right, but then there's also – okay, it is the same movie because Malcolm is in the second movie. Jeff Goldblum's character is in the second movie, if I remember correctly. Sam Neill comes back for the third movie, and then they end it. I don't think there's a fourth movie. No, there's no fourth movie.
Yeah.
but yeah, so Sam Neill comes back, and they're trying to get eggs. And again, I haven't seen this one in a while, so I'm like a little hazy on it. But, you know, there's an interesting dynamic because he's sort of training somebody, his protege, and you know, the guy essentially steals some eggs and wants to cultivate them again and all this other. It's better. And they're looking for a kid who got lost on the island while they were on vacation. The family was on vacation and the kid gets lost and they're all looking for this kid. And so Sam Neill gets brought back to help navigate them through the island to find this kid. That's essentially the plot. And it is pretty decent. Now, Jurassic World, which I know you also haven't seen, is, again, and I know I brought this up on last week's podcast, but it's kind of interesting how directors are taking new approaches at the same sort of material, if that makes any sense, and sort of polishing it up a bit. So The Force Awakens is a great example. Now, I know a lot of people hate to bring up the comparison between The Force Awakens and A New Hope, but you cannot deny that there are
very clear, very strong
similarities in terms of plot and even the way that heroes and villains are set up and all of that. Like, there's, again, very strong connections. Jurassic World does the exact same thing, which is interesting to me because that makes total sense in terms of why Lucasfilm was sort of interested in hiring Colin Trevorrow to do Star Wars, because, you know, he can play in the sandbox and he feels familiar. So essentially, Jurassic World is and if you remember Jurassic Park, is two kids get lost in the park and they send, you know, some people to go find them while there's, you know, a dinosaur loose. That's essentially the first Jurassic Park, except all of the dinosaurs were loose. Right. but it's one, you know, it's one dinosaur in particular that gets loose, and you know, the hunt is to find these two kids. And then what I think what makes this movie pretty good, I would give it like a B, is that it interweaves itself with Jurassic Park. So there are moments where the two kid characters find their way back to the original Jurassic Park scene. Like they're the Jurassic World is on the opposite side of the island where the original Jurassic Park was. So they end up going into that, you know, huge corridor where we end the first movie, the Jurassic Park movie, where the Tyrannosaurus Rex has fought off the Velociraptors and it does that epic roar, and then that banner kind of floats by it, you know, if dinosaurs rule the world kind of thing. I don't know if you remember that scene. But yeah, so they bring the kids back there, and in fact they drive one of the Jeeps that were in, that was in Jurassic Park to escape. So there's some really cute stuff.
Yeah, little fan service moments.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that you know, the kids touch the goggles that that little kid was wearing in the first movie. So there's bits of nostalgia woven in and out of that. The thing that I don't like, or I didn't like about Jurassic World, which is something that is hinted at in Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, is this idea of like these crazy hybrid dinosaurs. Like the dinosaur in Jurassic World was, I don't know, I guess his DNA was mixed from like a chameleon and a whole bunch of other things, so it could like disappear essentially into the background, which is an interesting thing, but it makes this dinosaur more of a monster than it's supposed to be. And it's like some genetic anomaly, you know, freakazoid. I don't really know what the hell it is. And
yeah,
it
feels like
that's what they're doing with this new movie.
The genetic element was obviously there in Jurassic Park, but it wasn't taken to that. It was basically just they were looking to, you know, recreate dinosaurs. Like the idea of them being, you know, let's really get creative with it and let's mix something with this so that it has the, you know, it can disappear or have traits or blend in, like any of that, that wasn't really there. But that is an interesting concept. Although I guess after, you know, depending on how you look at Jurassic World, and you would have a better perspective on this than I would, you know, having seen all of the movies, you said earlier that Jurassic World seemed to ignore everything except the first one, which means that we're kind of back talking about like what we talked about in the last episode, the Halloween episode, where the new Halloween is going to ignore everything except the first one, which I guess allowed Jurassic World to function almost as sort of a continuation and reboot sort of at the same time.
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess they do need to get bigger, better, or else you're back in the whole, like, well, kind of been there, done that.
Yeah. You know, yeah, I guess. But I mean, you know, and some of the images that I've seen from the trailers and stuff like that about the dinosaur creeping into somebody's home, I mean, that feels like Jurassic Park 2. So I'm like, I'm not checked in, not this one at all. I don't like this, you know, dinosaurs with, you know, opposable thumbs being able to open doors and turn handles and stuff like that. I don't like that at all. Yeah. It was cool to see a Velociraptor figure out that if they pushed on a handle and apply force that they could open a door.
Right.
But, you know, stuff like that, and it's like creepy long fingers working its way across a room while it's salivating to eat some kid underneath the covers. Like, come on.
It's funny, you know, when
that just doesn't do it for me, man.
When I saw the trailer or the teaser during the Super Bowl, I was like, you know, as somebody who hasn't seen anything but the first one, I was like, wow, that actually caught my attention. But then I think it might have actually been you. Somebody was like, but wait, but how did it get inside? And I was like, oh, well, yeah, you know what? That's a pretty good point.
A full-blown dinosaur either comes through the window and then manages to, like, sneak its head across a room. And it definitely didn't come up a flight of stairs. You know, I don't know how big this dinosaur is, but it's just, you know, it's just one of those things that I feel it's becoming more bombastic and exaggerated. You know, to kind of call back on some of the things that I remember about the Jurassic Park book, these little dinosaurs, regardless of the size, were a threat, right? So in the book, John Hammond does not escape the island. He dies. There's like these little itty bitty dinosaurs, maybe the size of a squirrel, but they swarm. They swarm him and they essentially eat him alive. And it's like that kind of stuff. I'm like, ooh, that's creepy.
That would have been dark. Yeah. That would have been. Yeah.
But I mean, you know, that's the reality of, I think, the, you know, the idea of having dinosaurs is that they were predatory. Well, most of them were predatory. Well, I don't know if most of them are. I'm not a freaking archaeologist. But in my mind, most of them are, you know, carnivores, and they're all out. They all got sharp teeth and they can eat you and all of that, to kind of amp it up by, you know, making some sort of genetically modified element to a creature that's already scary enough for me. You just kind of clown it. So I just, you know, I'm not interested. I'm just not, you know, I don't get it. And it feels, again, it feels like lost kids or lost somebody, you know, they're racing. I don't know if they're racing to save these things. And then the idea, you know, the other thing that's also diminishing this is just, or my idea of this movie or this franchise is in rewatching the first movie, I think the guy's name is Muldoon, the guy that works very closely with the raptors. He, you know, he talks about how smart they are and how they're kind of working things out, and they are they're essentially looking for ways to escape or to eat other things or people or whatever, right? There's a menacing factor built into the Velociraptor.
Yep.
And to kind of see them turn into these like allies, because Chris Pratt's character is first introduced to them and has trained them from, you know, when they were small. I mean, that's what John Hammond did in the first movie. Like, he says it as the first Velociraptor, you know, when we see the egg hatch and the Velociraptor comes out in Jurassic Park, he goes, "Oh, Henry, why didn't you tell me? I'd like to be here for all of them when they're first born." So he clearly had a connection, and he couldn't stop anything that happened in Jurassic Park.
Right, so, which was the whole point. Yeah.
Yeah, so you can't control nature. And then, you know, here you go. You've got Chris Pratt, who's like using a dog clicker, and, you know, he's got his pack of Velociraptors, you know, aiding him. So it's, you know, I don't know.
I mean, well, that's what you get to. I mean, and we've spoken about this, and actually I think we mentioned it in the last episode. You know, it's like as you start to have a franchise get into, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 movies, it's like this is the risk you take now. It's like, what is your franchise? You know, the original book, the movie, you know, Michael Crichton, those are the types of themes he tends to deal with. Yeah. In a lot of his stories. I mean, you're a big Westworld fan. I know that.
Oh,
and it's not a very dissimilar theme to Westworld. Yeah. You know, when you think about it, like the whole idea of like trying to manufacture something, but nature is what it is and you can't really stop it. It's a running theme in a lot of his stories. So, mm-hmm. and that's why I'm assuming the Jurassic Park book was darker than the movie wound up being.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, obviously the movie gets the Spielberg treatment. And it's only going to be so dark. But now we're into this next phase of this franchise. And it's interesting because, you know, the original, if you look at the box office numbers for the original three movies, the first one does over $1 billion worldwide, which 25 years ago was just incredible, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, but then after that, like the next movie made, you know, a little more than half that. And then right. The third movie made, like, I think I saw it earlier, like $380 million worldwide or something like that.
Mm.
So obviously there was a significant diminishing returns on that. And then it disappeared, right, for a while. And I think most people assume that it was done. That was it. Mm-hmm. Then Jurassic World comes, and I don't know that anybody expected Jurassic World to do what it did at the box office. I mean, it was just, that was insane.
Yeah, I certainly didn't. So... this is also an interesting intersection. So in my personal life, I was working, this is a side anecdote. So I was working on a particular client that had a pretty significant product placement in Jurassic World. And For those of you that don't know, I work in PR. So this client came to us, to my agency, and said, you know, we've just, you know, made a significant investment in Jurassic World. It's going to be directed by this like up and coming director, and we'll have elements that link itself back to Jurassic Park and blah, blah, blah. We've got this really cool feature, and we want, you know, you guys to come up with a plan and show exclusive content on, you know, on these TVs, blah, 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 blah. And I'm sitting here thinking, dude, you guys just put your freaking money in a lemon.
Yeah.
Like, I'm with great you. Job, guys. I get this it. Is going to yep. sink. Nobody cares about Jurassic World. Nobody cares about Jurassic Park anymore. Like, what did you guys just do? And this guy, this marketing director, was saying to me, oh, you don't understand. Like, this movie's going to do gangbusters in the box office. And, you know, you'll see. And I'm like, dude, what are you smoking? And boy, was I wrong.
Yeah, they certainly, that movie, and maybe, you know, it was underestimating Chris Pratt, who had, you know,
yeah, it was
has become a big star. Yep. Yeah. I'm sure it was more than that. I mean, it certainly captured the international box office's imagination, because it just did ridiculous numbers overseas as well. But, you know, I still can't really wrap my head around, you know, why that movie was the phenomenon that it was. It, you know, it's unusual to see a franchise that's essentially put on ice for a long time kind of be revived and have the next movie, whether you consider it the fourth movie or the first of a new generation of movies, be the biggest.
Dude, it's
of
Star
all
Wars.
Of them. It
became Star Wars for dinosaurs.
Apparently it has. And it was, you know, completely surprising. I mean, if you look at the other two franchises that I talked about earlier, as far as ones that I had only seen the first movies,
yeah.
Transformers and Pirates. Now, they were never really put on ice at any point yet anyway. But like, as they kept making more movies, like every time they would make one, somebody would say, okay, this is the one now that's going to bring it back to, you know, this one now. Yeah, the last movie didn't do as well, but this one now is going to be the one. And then, like, that just wouldn't happen.
Right.
So it's like, now here comes Jurassic World, and it's like, man, this is already now like an A-list franchise again.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting thought about, you know, those kinds of franchises that seriously hit the pause button. Right. And
yep.
Because for all intents and purposes, to us as, you know, consumers of the medium and all of that, it feels like it was dead, like it was gone. Right. And then it just kind of came out of nowhere and shocked the hell out of everybody, because I think what it did was it had all of the elements that made the first one feel so good and great. You know what I mean? Like, again, the story felt very, very samey, but they were nice little, you know, hat tips to those that were familiar with the franchise, like myself, that kind of look that, you know, I was watching and I'm like, oh, this is cool. You know, they just dropped these kids off right back where the first park started, and, you know, they're having these, you know, they're interacting with things from 1993 that you're like, holy cow. Now, some of it's like unbelievable stuff, you know, these kids fix a Jeep, like one kid's maybe like 14 years old and his brother's like 11 or right. 12, whatever, and they're fixing a Jeep, like, oh yeah, do you remember when we fixed that, blah blah blah. It's like, shut the hell up, you guys don't know what the hell you're doing. But no, it had all of the good feels to it, you know, and you walk away from the film, you know, like, all right, that was pretty good, that wasn't bad. I enjoyed that, and I've watched it again, and, you know, of course, there are moments when I kind of check out, but it's still ultimately a good movie, and I thought it paid respect to the first film. You know, the other interesting thing is that the Tyrannosaurus Rex that they bring out in Jurassic World is the same Tyrannosaurus Rex from the first movie, from the second movie. So it's like, what's the life cycle of these Jurassic Park freaking dinosaurs, man? Some 20 years they can live.
Whatever. Hey, why not?
Yeah, they gotta.
I mean,
bring
if you
out
could believe that dinosaurs can walk the earth again, then why put restrictions on how long they can
how long they can
walk?
Live, right? Yeah. And the fact that, you know, this poor Tyrannosaurus Rex, you know, basically saves the day in the first movie, gets dropped off in the middle of the city, chasing its kid around, I don't know what happens to it in the third movie. I don't even know if it pops up there. But then they're still back in captivity, back on the island that it thought it left some 20-something years ago. Poor thing.
Yeah.
Oh, whatever.
I think, you know, dinosaurs are one of those things that I don't think they really lose their appeal with kids. Like, I know when I was a little kid, there was a couple of year period where I was obsessed with dinosaurs.
Yeah.
You know, like around first, second grade. Like, it was just, I knew all of them. I had, you know, the models and everything. And so, like, and by the time Jurassic Park had come out, obviously I was older and not in that phase anymore. But it still kind of spoke to that part of me. So, I mean, I still, you know, there's kids today, they're still fascinated with dinosaurs. They're, you know, they're this larger than life thing that is almost like mythical. And so I could see where the concept could still capture, you know, a lot of people's attention and be successful. I just didn't realize it could be that successful still at this point. And we'll see what happens with this next one.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I know, you know, our trusted and valued friend over there at the El Fanboy podcast, Mr. Mario Robles, was talking about his son being really into dinosaurs. So, of course, he would take him to see the film. So, thankfully, my daughter has no idea of what those things are. She gets scared. It's funny because, you know, she's about to turn two. And she gets scared at, like, the funniest things except for the things that I love. So she loves Darth Vader. Oh, my God. But we were watching Coco, and as soon as the characters turned into skeletons, oh, man, was it a meltdown.
Oh, really? Yeah, there's no rhyme or reason at that point, at that age, to really what's going to work and what isn't.
Yeah, it's just, it could be like the dumbest thing, you know, like a freaking squirrel runs across the street and she'll be freaked out. I don't know. But yeah, so, you know, we'll see. If I were to take a stab in the dark in terms of its box office projections, and I don't know if folks have been out there talking about, but I don't really think it's going to do anywhere close to the first movie. But we'll, you know, time will tell.
Yeah,
we'll see.
I mean, the numbers I saw earlier today said something about like 135 million opening weekend, which is nothing to sneeze at, obviously. It's not the insane numbers that the first one did, and it would definitely be a big drop, but I don't know that anybody's going to cry over necessarily over 135 million, especially depending on what it does overseas, which you would think the way the overseas box office is working these days, that it'll probably do just as well, if not even a little better.
It's already dropped, right?
Overseas. Yeah, it's already done like 370 million overseas. It hasn't even opened yet.
It's money back.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll see a third movie.
I'm going to think it's pretty safe. So, right? That, yeah, something remarkable, I think, would have to happen for it to not get a third movie.
Yeah. Well, here's to you, Jurassic World.
All right. So, Aaron, we actually have our first guest on the Fanboy Garage on the line right now, and he has a bone to pick with you.
I'm shaking in my boots, man.
Rick Shue from Batman on Film wanted to come on to discuss a story that you wrote for, or a column that you wrote for Revenge of the Fans, titled Why the World Does Not Need an Obi-Wan Kenobi Movie. So just to give a little bit of the history on this, in episode 4 of the show, we had our discussion on Solo. And as two longtime Star Wars fans, we disagreed on the movie. You liked it, I didn't. And that led to a further discussion about the current state of our fandom. And I had made a comment about how I felt like I was evolving as a fan and I wanted to see Star Wars taken to new and unfamiliar places. And I guess you kind of took some of that to heart and started thinking of it yourself. And that led to you writing this rather shocking article, considering you're one of the biggest Star Wars fans in the world. So Rick wanted to come on to discuss that very nicely with you. So Rick Shue from Batman on Film, welcome to the Fanboy Garage.
Welcome.
Well, I appreciate the welcome. And may I just say, I'm actually used to doing these shows in the morning, whether it's our on-camera vlogs or podcasts. So I have a beer here and a little bit of whiskey, and I think I'm drinking just to loosen myself up a little bit because your article made me so furious and angry. Completely kidding. No, listen, I read the article, and I have a lot of respect for Aaron and Chris. You and I are just meeting for the first time here, and I just wanted to discuss it because I did have some issues with it, respectfully so.
So for those folks that didn't get a chance to read it on Revenge of the Fans, I do certainly urge you to check it out. It's still up on the site. But to kind of quickly summarize this, and I'm going to do it from, 30,000 feet. Essentially, my point here in terms of why the world and we as fans don't necessarily need an Obi-Wan Kenobi movie is that there is no real risk in seeing a story about Obi-Wan, right? So one of the points I bring up in the article is that Obi-Wan needs to end up in the same place where we first meet him in A New Hope, right? And that's on Tatooine. Anything that happens between Revenge of the Sith and A New Hope is null. Now, while I'm sure that there are really cool and interesting stories that one could explore within that time period, which is essentially just 19 years, Rebels does dip in and out of that time period a bit. And for those that don't watch that show, I certainly urge you to check it out and check that out as well. There isn't really anything that can happen to Obi-Wan that I feel would further his character or shed anything more on what we already know of the character. And I don't necessarily think we need it. Even if we did see something cool that maybe he had a child or he was married or whatever the case, it doesn't really change who we know Obi-Wan to be. Now, it may put things, kind of spin off into some of the new stories that we're exploring in this new sort of film franchise and the, Skywalker saga that we're continuing from, episode 7, 8, and 9. But again, ultimately, I just don't think that it's going to hold any weight. So much like Solo, it becomes sort of filler and it adds additional color. But I don't necessarily think that that's stuff that we need. And I don't necessarily think the franchise itself needs to tell those stories. So, Rick, the floor is yours. I have swung first. Please.
Come Q Rock. So tomorrow or Wednesday, the Creed 2 trailer drops. So I'm like Q Rocky music. Gloves are, I guess in this case, the gloves are on, whatever, right? So here's the thing. There's a lot to unpack in that. And what I'll say is this, is Aaron, when I read your article and a little bit of context here, you and I have done a couple podcasts together. Mario has become a friend of Batman on Film and vice versa with the Hellfan Boy podcast. And then through him and our shows, you and I have met and we've created this bond and we're buddies. And you're my go-to Star Wars guy sometimes, especially with The Last Jedi hate. I'm like, where's Aaron? I'm gonna loop him in on Twitter and we're going to gang up on the hate. Here's what I'll say. I actually agree with a great deal of your article from a symbolic perspective. And what I mean by that is this. We don't need to continue to harp on the nostalgia of Star Wars. I don't want to see a Boba Fett movie. I don't want to see a Qui-Gon film. I don't want to see a Darth Vader movie. Quite frankly, I think Rogue One gave us as much of a Darth Vader movie as we need. Mm-hmm. I don't want to see a Yoda movie. I get all that. Quite frankly, I want Episode 9 to tie up the Skywalker saga because that's what it is. I want that damn Obi-Wan movie, and I want my children to succeed in life, okay? But I don't want anything beyond an Obi-Wan film and Episode 9 to have a damn thing to do with the Skywalker saga. End it, kill it, as Kylo says, let the past die, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that with Rian Johnson's trilogy that I hope that we still get, I hope that online jackassery backlash doesn't affect that. I don't think it will, but I hope it doesn't, but whatever. Regardless, we know that John Favreau and we have all these other things that are coming our way via television and comics and what have you, etc., that this universe is about to expand in front of our very eyes, that we're about to start seeing stories that are unfolding that have nothing to do with the Skywalker saga. And that's exactly what needs to happen. Also, I want to say is that I am a fan of the film Solo. I also can say in the same breath, we didn't need it. That's not what this franchise needed. And that film is sort of, when I read your article, I felt like, well, we could just sort of make that Solo, take out Obi-Wan, and it would be, in my view, 100% relevant. Even though I smiled through the whole damn thing, I saw it 3 times, saw it 2 weeks early at a press screening, and it was coming out of my skin. I couldn't talk about it for 12 days. But I get it. I get that. I'm not even surprised by those box office poor performance. I'm just really not. It was poorly marketed, and it's a film that no one asked for, no one wanted. However, an Obi-Wan film, Gotta have it.
There's so many reasons why
we need it. So let me just say that.
Okay, so if you could rank those reasons, give me your number one reason why we absolutely need an Obi-Wan Kenobi movie.
First of all, he had the most important line in The Force Awakens, albeit a line that was swallowed a little bit in terms of just the sound quality and whatnot. But at the end of the day, it was still the most important line in the entire film. And quite frankly, it's still the most important line in the sequel trilogy. And Ewan McGregor came to JJ's studio and recorded the line. And he said, "Rey, first steps." Now, they end up taking his Rey and making that Alec Guinness saying the word Rey. But that's more just that was just sort of a fun thing they did in post. But at the end of the day, Ewan McGregor has a voiceover in The Force Awakens, and he says, "Rey, these are your first steps." I refuse to let that go.
Okay.
We need to know why. And that entire sequence in The Force Awakens, when she finds Anakin's, Luke's, whatever you want to call it, lightsaber, now it's hers, or now it's destroyed. And she has that flashback sequence. You see them friend.
Yeah.
You hear all kinds of cool stuff, man. You hear Yoda. You hear Palpatine from Empire. Here, just known as the Emperor at that point. But the only new recording of an actual dialogue, other than the little girl screaming at her parents, which was Rey's a little girl, other than that, is Ewan McGregor's voice saying, "Rey, these are your first steps." And if you think about it, if you take the sequel trilogy, if you take Force Awakens and The Last Jedi, and you boil it down, that line from Obi-Wan Kenobi, which in essence is a Force ghost, he's talking to her from
Right.
the Force. We need to know why the hell he said that to her. And that's not an old rehashed, recycled line from Return of the Jedi or New Hope or Empire. That is Ewan McGregor talking to her.
I mean, that's all well and good. For me, you can't make a whole movie off of why he said that to her.
I didn't say that. It's not what I said.
No, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but you're saying that there's prominence in him being the only voice that is new, right? Because essentially everything else is from the past, right?
Yes, sir.
And that's the only new piece of dialogue. So he is the only character not speaking around her, but speaking to her.
Exactly.
Right?
Right.
I get that. What I would like to see to kind of take your idea is, yes, Ewan McGregor does appear as Obi-Wan Kenobi, but as a Force ghost in Episode 9. And he with Luke and with, who knows, maybe Hayden Christensen as Anakin Skywalker and Yoda are all contributing to her training and sort of growth of as a Jedi and her new Jedi Order. That makes sense to me. But I already have bits and pieces of Obi-Wan's training, things that he has done. They explored a lot of this in the Clone Wars. And I know, you know, you and I kind of talked offline about there's license to rejigger canon as it relates to the Clone Wars and Rebels and all of that stuff. I vehemently disagree with that because so many people are sort of tuned into that stuff that I think that if they were to do that, you would cause an even further backlash among fandom.
I want to explore that just as a footnote, but I'm sorry, continue.
Sure. I don't think that because what he says to her needs to link to something that he has either done or has sort of discovered in his past, because we already know that Qui-Gon and Qui-Gon himself was the one who was teaching both Yoda and Obi-Wan how to be, you know, commune as a Force ghost, right? He discovers that himself as he navigates the world, whatever it's called. So yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't really see it.
Let me ask you this. Did anything I say this in terms of I agree that everything else, all this, do you guys curse on your show at all? Yeah.
No.
All this crap. I'll say crap then. All this crap that people are throwing out in terms of, I want a Boba Fett movie. I want this. And I know some of this stuff was actually in discussions to be in development. And I hope it doesn't. Hope it doesn't.
Yeah, James Mangold.
We don't need that. Less is more almost always. But with Obi-Wan, to me, it's there's a few different ways to look at this. First of all, I don't think that they'll have the vision or the foresight to make Ewan McGregor look like an older Obi-Wan. You know what I mean by that? Like Rian Johnson, you know, even had said that, and I think in the commentary, one of the Blu-ray, you know, features, whatever, that he couldn't have Ewan McGregor because he wouldn't look like Luke. Remembered him. I'm going, what? No, just put him in makeup. Make him look a little older. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
So I'm afraid that JJ might very well agree with that, and they wouldn't use him. Although I don't think any of us. Listen, here's the deal. I like the prequels. I'll defend them, and quite frankly, I freaking love Revenge of the Sith. And so I'm a prequel warrior. But at the end of the day, there's a lot of fans that hated the prequels. We talk about The Last Jedi, but you know, the original backlash was, I guess, really technically the special editions and then the prequels. But even the most like passionate like prequel hater, right? They love Ewan McGregor as Obi-Wan. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We've all accepted him in the role. So I think it's completely fine if they decided to just make him look older and put him in the film. There's nothing wrong with that, but they probably won't. And so there's that part of it that is a little bit troublesome for me. But aside from even the voiceover, here's a couple other reasons why I think we need this film. First of all, he's such an important character in this whole franchise and the Skywalker saga. And you think about it, there's very little we actually know about him because he was very underused in episode one. He was more or less sort of a detective in episode two and kind of a bitchy guy to Anakin or whatever. And Anakin in episode three, he was very well written and his acting was fantastic. And part of it also is like, well, I want to see a little bit more of him and why he contributes so much to this, because he's in Empire and Return of the Jedi collectively, like very little. And quite frankly, he really wasn't in New Hope all that much if you think about it.
Right.
So I would like to just see more of what drives him. And I think there is a story to tell that would be compelling. And Kristen Harloff, Collider, so I want to give credit to him on this. I don't want to sound like I thought of this, but I agree with it. He said, you know, there's a really interesting part in Return of the Jedi, and it's when Luke surrenders to Vader, and he's going to take him to his emperor, and he's basically saying to him, I'm going to paraphrase that, you couldn't bring yourself to kill me. You can't do this. There's still good in you. Come on, Father, don't. And he says to Luke, he says, you know, Obi-Wan once thought the way you did, and he was wrong, or something like that, and that raises eyebrows. Like, when what that's not established in the previous film, so it would lead me to believe that there's another time that they have met just by virtue of that state, just by virtue of that conversation alone. And I think there could be something very compelling to that could enrich both Obi-Wan and Vader himself.
Yeah. So. And I as a follower of Jedi Council, Collider's Jedi Council, I did hear that line. I thought, initially I thought it was super interesting, the idea of exploring another potential interaction between the two of them, between Vader and Obi-Wan. And then I thought to myself, is this just the Kessel Run all over again? After seeing Solo, right? Do I really need to see the Kessel Run? Did I need to see that? Even though I loved it, I loved watching it. I thought it was awesome. Or how he gets the Millennium Falcon, awesome. You know, seeing all of that stuff. But do I need to see that? Like, what is it going to do? Essentially, they're going to have a battle. You know, he's going to say, Anakin, you were my brother. I still sense good in you. Blah, blah, blah. And Vader's like, I'm all out for killing. And it doesn't go anywhere because they're not going to do anything. We know that Obi-Wan isn't going to kill Vader. And we know Vader isn't going to kill Obi-Wan. And we know that the Emperor has nothing to do with any of that because he's going to still do what he does. Could they throw in another apprentice? Maybe.
Well, there's one that's still lurking in continuity now. Because now we have...
Ezra Bridger?
Well, no. Now we have Darth Maul. And I don't think there's going to be a solo sequel. And quite frankly, it probably shouldn't be.
No.
And it's a fun film. I'm glad they made it. I think they marketed it terrible. I think the timing was terrible, etc. But the fact is that Maul is there. Do they have to recreate Rebels exactly? I respectfully disagree with that. And you know when I say respectfully, you know I mean that, especially with you. Yeah. I just – look, I know when you said earlier, well, that's going to piss off more fans and whatever. You know, I think that thinking about what fans are going to like and don't like is you have to take it into consideration for sure. But you also just story and make a film. And I don't – if you think about the people that are aware of the story – between Obi-Wan and Darth Maul and Rebels. I mean, at the end of the day, when you talk about people that go to see these films, that's like a small percentage of people that really even know what that is, right? They don't know. I mean, most people that saw Solo saw Darth Maul, they're like, what? So this happened before The Phantom Menace? They don't even know that
right,
he was in,
right.
You know what I'm saying? They don't think he was in Clone Wars. They don't think he was in Rebels. They don't think he was in the comics.
Yeah, they're not like the diehard folks that –
no,
I've been following all of the stories and the content that's been rolling out.
And even something like Batman, where the source material is the book, even with that, the majority of the people that see Batman or Avengers, they've never read a book. They don't, that's not, it's a different medium. And I that the majority of the people, just as diehard fans, we have a loud microphone, right? Because we're on Twitter, on social media, and we, you know, my wife will go see. She went and saw The Dark Knight with me like 4 times. She's never posted once anywhere on social media about a Batman movie. And she's never read a Batman comic, but she loves The Dark Knight. And I think that she represents the vast majority of people that actually go to the movies. And so there's that also to sort of play with or what have you. But if you don't mind, and it's your show, so I feel weird as a guest asking questions. It's kind of, it just, it's natural to me anyway. So forgive me, but you used to want it. And I read your article, and I respect it, everything. I'm still just curious to know exactly what made you not want it. Also what you just said a moment ago about, well, we already know what's going to happen. We don't need it. Well, by that same mentality, we never needed the prequels. And hell, maybe you think that we didn't. But back to what I was just saying is that I'm curious to know what triggered that, because if it's, hey man, The Force Awakens was a little bit too much on the nose with the nostalgia, which I agree with that. The Last Jedi certainly wasn't at all, and something you and I both appreciate. So what was that? What was the catalyst for this change of heart?
So I'm going to actually flip that to Chris for a quick second, because where my mind went after our fourth episode where we talked about Solo. And I'm not going to take the words out of Chris's mouth, but you know, there was something about needing to ask myself, what do I want from Star Wars? And what is it, what's happening to the franchise now that has starting to sour some folks? But also what is it about the franchise that gets me really excited? So Chris,
but if you don't mind before, and I'm dying to hear this from Chris. But when you say sour some folks, can we just take that for just 2 seconds and acknowledge that Star Wars fandom
it's doing some really interesting stuff again.
Sure
it's
is.
Just, this is nothing new. I don't know how old you guys are. I'm 3. I graduated college in 98, dude. Phantom Menace came out in 99. I was already out of school, college when that movie came out. I was an adult. I lived through those prequels as a adult. And fandom was horrendous. They just didn't have Twitter,
right.
And they didn't have Facebook, and people were pissed off about the special editions. I've had more arguments with people about George using Hayden Christensen as Anakin's Force Ghost other than Sebastian Shaw than I have the freaking.
That's how you and I our relationship started, man.
Yeah, but other than Luke milking the cow, so I just want to say that it's an interesting place right now, sure, but it's really not. It's always been toxic. Anyway, yeah, I just want to say that. So I'm sorry,
Chris,
please.
Yeah, so it's ironic, actually, what I'm about to say, because while my whole opinion on like how my fandom was evolving and I wanted to see Star Wars go to new and unfamiliar places was a driving force behind my thoughts on Solo. As much as I hate to disagree with Aaron again, since it's the first time we disagreed was on about Star Wars was on Solo, and now we're going to disagree again on this. But ironically, I would actually look forward to an Obi-Wan movie. And the reason why is because while I want to see Star Wars taken to new and unfamiliar places, it doesn't necessarily mean it only has to be new and unfamiliar characters in those places. Like, I'm perfectly fine with seeing familiar characters taken to new places. That's what I loved about The Last Jedi. The Last Jedi took these familiar characters and threw them into these unfamiliar and new places. It took Star Wars to new places. And I get it that, you know, there's polarizing thoughts and people weren't happy with Luke and this, that, but I loved The Last Jedi. So for me, taking these characters where they took them was brilliant to me. So I think the Obi-Wan movie, where the Solo movie was very much about checking off the boxes, right? Han meets Chewie, Han meets Lando, Han gets the Falcon, so on. We've checked off a lot of the boxes already with Obi-Wan. You know, a lot of the things that we've heard about, we've seen now. We saw him meet Anakin. We saw him fight Anakin. You know, we saw the Clone Wars. We've seen a lot of those things. So I think the Obi-Wan movie gives us a perfect opportunity to get a familiar character and to put that character in some new and unfamiliar places without having to worry so much about checking off the boxes. And if it could be Ewan McGregor, that's even better, because there's a familiar actor playing that character. Like Rick said earlier, and this is something that I definitely agree with, no matter what you think of the prequels, pretty much everyone agrees that Ewan McGregor was great as Obi-Wan. So it even gives you that. Like, you don't even have to worry about, okay, now how am I going to accept this person as Obi-Wan? You don't even have to worry about that. So for me, that's why I would really look forward to this. So I know that sort of seems like it would conflict a little bit with my thoughts on Solo, but in a lot of ways it doesn't, because I feel like Solo for me wasn't so much about the, you know, the familiar. It was how they went about it.
Go ahead, Rick.
No, please go ahead.
I was gonna say, I mean, I think the you know, your comparison to The Last Jedi is interesting for me, because we're on the same page, of course, with, you know, all three of us on The Last Jedi. I mean, we all love the movie. I think it's an interesting take because there's an unknown factor. Right. There is an unknown to where Luke Skywalker, you know, who Luke Skywalker was at the moment we meet him on Octo. We don't know what's happened to him. There are some mysteries left. And I think that's why we were able to take those familiar characters and push the envelope a bit. And I actually think that's probably one of the main reasons why people have such a visceral reaction to what they've done with Luke Skywalker, is because he was not the Luke Skywalker people expected. I just showed my wife for the first time The Last Jedi. She's like, I don't really do science fiction. I'm not. She's like, you love Star Wars. That's more than enough for me. I'm good with it. I don't want to watch it. And so I kind of pulled the trump card on Father's Day and said, guess what we're watching? And she said, fine. So we watched The Last Jedi, and the first thing that came out of her mouth was, what the F happened to this guy? Why is he such a curmudgeon? And I love the fact that she had that reaction, right? The thing about comparing Obi-Wan to, you know, to like taking him somewhere new is that, and to reference my article again, he has to end up on the same place though. His trajectory is already set in stone, regardless of what happens from B to Y, right? YZ. He still has to end up at Z, right? And we've already seen how he started in the prequels. So everything else is like inconsequential. It doesn't matter. It's like,
but can we say that about the prequels themselves?
No, absolutely. Believe me, I didn't ask for the prequels. And what I got from the prequels was more about Obi-Wan actually, and his relationship with Anakin versus a Vader story. I mean, there are elements of, it's funny, I think it was you, Rick. I think you, were you talking about the Phantom Menace recently?
I was tweeting about it. I have a love-hate relationship with that film.
So, we were talking about the pod racing scene, right? Too. But there are some interesting things that were actually cut out of The Phantom Menace, like Anakin losing his temper and beating the crap out of Greedo, right? You should watch the deleted scenes, by the way.
Yeah, which is terrible because it's Jake Lloyd. Anyway,
But what was interesting about that and why I appreciated that cut scene and why I wish they had put it in was because you get a glimpse of his temper. You get a glimpse of somebody who's a little bit off and who has some difficulties controlling his emotions. And I thought that was something that was missing from the prequels. Now, what we got is what we got. And I think ultimately they pulled it off with Revenge of the Sith. But,
well, I mean, you don't think that you saw that when Anakin slaughtered the Sand People?
Absolutely. But
that's episode two, though.
No, I know. But what I'm saying is because I watched the deleted scenes like before I watched Attack of the Clones.
Okay. Fair enough.
I loved seeing that quick scene, but I hated not seeing all of it because again, and the reason why I love Darth Vader the way I do is because I grew up with everyone saying, oh, you're so angry. Yada, yada. And I love watching that kind of displayed in front of me of like, this is what real anger looks like. I'm just aggressive. And I can identify with where he's coming from, but like I wanted to see more of it, and we just get a quick little glimpse of him like cutting off some people's heads, and I wanted to see him like murder the entire village of Sand People, the women, the children, the dogs, all of that stuff, and we didn't get it, but because that really shows me the depths of his emotional imbalance. And in reading some of the books that have come out about Vader and watching him, you know, channel the Force to commit the worst, most murderous crimes against the universe is awesome to read and to see. And I kind of wish we got a little more of that. But again, we did in Rogue One, which is brilliant. But going back to Obi-Wan, I just feel like they spent more time with Anakin sort of taking him from a child and then fostering that, and they didn't execute it very well. And that's another reason why I'm like, this is they're like kind of 0-for-2 here. Right. Now, I know that you're a big prequel fan, but that really, the story for Vader wasn't really executed to the best of its ability.
It was so, not.
Solo was fun, but again, wasn't necessary. And, you know, here we are with, you know, them wanting to kind of dip back into their favorite characters, Boba Fett, you know, Jabba the Hutt, Yoda, yada, yada, and Obi-Wan Kenobi. And it's like, we know where they're going.
But you say a lot like what we need, what we want. And what does that really mean? And I've caught myself doing it, gentlemen. I have said, no one asked for this Solo movie. No one wanted it. Well, what the hell does that mean? Did anybody ask for The Last Jedi? Did anybody ask for any of these films? Anybody, you know what I'm saying? Like, what fundamentally does that mean? And that's something that I think kind of needs to be explored a little bit in terms of, because we all say it, we say it a lot. And in terms of this franchise, what is it at the end of the day is your ultimate vision for the franchise in 20 years or 10 years? We're probably all three on the same page. And that's why, again, I'll say it one more time. I've said it three or four times. I don't want to beat a dead horse here. I cringe at all these spinoff talkabouts. I want none of them.
Yeah.
But I want Obi-Wan. And I want one Obi-Wan movie. I don't want a trilogy. And I want the film to be – this is another reason I want it. I think the right director and writer can come in. And what if this was truly a character study film? We don't even need a space dogfight. Like, make this the first Star Wars film. We don't even have that. We don't need it. The budget will be less just by virtue of less special effects. And a character-driven story that I think could be fascinating. And also, as a director of the prequels, and this is kind of self-serving, but I also want this film because even though I defend the prequels and I like them, they are poorly written. They're terribly directed. That's just – you can't deny that. Mm-hmm. And I think Ewan McGregor deserves it. And I would like also to retroactively make those films a little better and make his his performance a little bit more in the
yeah.
Oh, and his hair more consistent.
I don't have a problem with that. You know, I can get past a lot of things.
To talk about, because Aaron mentioned it a couple of times about how, you know, it's like, well, we know where these characters are going to end up. And, you know, that kind of kills things for him. But for me, I don't mind knowing where the characters are going to end up, because I always thought the idea of these Star Wars stories was to tell sort of these isolated stories within the universe that could kind of stand on their own. And they weren't going to be so consumed with connecting the dots. Now, if you're a hardcore fan, you're obviously always going to be able to connect dots, but they would be kind of standalone. I use Rogue One as the example because, we talked about this in either episode 3 or 4, like what I love Rogue One. And what I loved about Rogue One was the fact that I ultimately knew what was going to happen to all of these characters, right? Because we knew they weren't around for A New Hope. But I was immediately invested in all of those characters and their story. And while I knew, for the most part, how it was ultimately going to end, I still was along for the ride. So I still think that you could be along for the ride and the journey could be fascinating, regardless of what happens or what you know is going to happen to those characters, if you tell like an isolated story where you're not looking to connect it necessarily right into something or connect a whole bunch of dots or check off a whole bunch of boxes. That's kind of what I was always hoping that these Star Wars stories were going to be.
Yeah, I mean, Rogue One for me is different because I didn't necessarily, I mean, while I had an inclination that all of these characters weren't going to make it out of the movie, I wasn't positive, right? I didn't know 100% that these folks weren't going to pop up somewhere else. You know, it's kind of interesting because, you know, Star Wars has been doing some really interesting, well, I'd say the story team at Lucasfilm is doing some really interesting stuff, like Commander Rex from the Clone Wars and one of the clone troopers from the prequels has sort of popped up as the guy with the white beard in Return of the Jedi. So like they're kind of retrofitting some of these characters to have lived, you know, throughout certain pieces of, you know, the cinematic stories that are being told. So I wasn't necessarily sure, you know, going back to my original comment about Rogue One, that these people were going to live or die. Ultimately, I'm glad that they did die because that saves me a whole lot of grief for looking for Easter eggs and all of that stuff. I just think, you know, the point for me is, you know, from a character arc perspective, right? Obi-Wan at the end of Revenge of the Sith has his purpose, right? He gives Luke to Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru, and he assumes his position of, okay, I'm going to be silent watch keeper. I'll be keeping an eye on Luke. In Rebels, which I, again, Rick, to your point, I know that many people have not seen Rebels. There's a really interesting conversation that happens between Maul and Obi-Wan about why is he on this planet? And he said something like, you found purpose or, sure. You know,
and it's great. It's great.
Yeah, and it's a great thing. And then they do the callback and you hear Aunt Beru call Luke's name and they play the iconic Luke Skywalker theme. Great.
And he's on the space camel that he was at the end of Sith as well when he did
it. Right, right. So, that's interesting. And I don't know, maybe it's a couple of years, maybe 10 years, 8 years before the start of A New Hope, right? So it just kind of feels like for me, because I'm a consumer of all things Star Wars, be it the books and the shows and the cartoons and the movies and all that stuff, I already kind of have a complete picture.
Bingo.
A decent enough picture of Obi-Wan Kenobi and what he did, you know, and I followed Clone Wars like to the very end. So I have, I know who Obi-Wan Kenobi is. And I think we're hitting on this right now. That's the point for me.
That's the point for you. Yes.
Yeah, I think I'm kind of done with the character because I've already seen years of his story.
Now take yourself out of that for a moment if you can, because quite frankly, you are far more of a dedicated Star Wars fan than I am in that regard. I don't consume myself with the EU. I watched a lot of Clone Wars. What's that?
The EU doesn't exist anymore.
Well, whatever you want to call it, semantics. I've read a couple of books. Again, to me, it was never the source material. The source material were the films. Whereas, like, you know, if I go, you know, I go a couple of years and I'm not reading comics, and I start getting self-conscious about that. And I'm like, I got to start Batman. This is who he is. This is where he's from. And I start burying myself in comics. But with Star Wars, it's not like that. The films are truly the continuity. They are truly the canon to 97% of the people that will see these films. And yes, there are millions of people that will embrace the extended universe, the books, the comics, whatever. But there's just such a small percentage of the people that see these movies. And that's also why I think you should try to remove yourself from that, is that the general audience, which again is the vast majority that will see this movie that have never read a comic, watch Rebels, any of that, I think they deserve it. I think they deserve an Obi-Wan story that's compelling, because that is Star Wars to them. It's just the movies. And I agree with you. Again, I'm talking in circles here, but man, F all the rest of this stuff. Ditch it. Kill it. Let's just do this film for a multitude of reasons. I want it because he was very significant in Dickens' most important line in the sequel trilogy, to my humble opinion. I want to explore what Kristen Harloff pointed out, because the more I think about it, the more I watch it, I'm like, that's a story. I want to see something with Maul, because now he's established and we can have him in the film. You don't have to recreate what happened in Rebels. You need to honor it, and it has to be in the spirit of it. But give me that one movie, and then you can I'll march with you in DC, and we'll say no more Skywalker like era continuity in film.
Yeah, I mean the Maul thing is interesting. I don't necessarily think that they'll do the Maul thing, because a lot of his motivation is actually tracking down and finding Kenobi in the in Rebels.
I get it.
They'd have to retcon a lot of that stuff if they were to put them back in the same arena again. The Vader thing is interesting to me, but then again, I mean, and I asked this question of both of you: if Vader had popped up in Solo, would the interest have been? Would it have been different in the movie if he had popped up? Because I'm a firm.
Are you talking like individual interest, or like in general?
General audiences had they done a quick trailer with a quick snapshot of Vader like being around, would that have changed audiences' reaction to Solo? Because I'll give you my quick take or hot take on this one. I think he's the secret sauce. I think that if you strip that last Vader scene from Rogue One, it makes it dramatically less. Like it's not as good of a movie, because I think the payoff is the Vader scene at the end. Like major payoff. I can watch Rogue One, but I will always go back to that Vader scene and just watch that thing by itself over and over and over again, because I think it's so awesomely done and choreographed and all of that.
But is it just that last scene? Because you know what did it for me? Was Mustafar, and the fact
I love that scene too.
It's the only planet, and correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, Aaron, about this, but I'm pretty sure it's the only planet when they establish it don't say what it is.
Yes, it is
the base. You're or whatever. Right. And I think that's also an interesting choice, because they wanted you to go, what is this? And go, the volcanoes. Like, oh wow, he more or less murdered his wife. His best friend slaughtered him. Yeah. And that this is where he has chosen to have like solitude, and that's so effed up that Vader would choose that. So those payoffs were to me. Now, you know, the don't choke on your ambitions or whatever. I mean, you know what?
I love that line, man.
I think it's a great line. People think it's cheesy. I'm like, yeah, a lot of his lines were cheesy.
Yeah. But if he had popped up in Han Solo, do you think it would have changed, like, quite frankly, the box office results?
I think this. I didn't want him in Solo. I did want either Boba Fett or Jabba Hutt. We got Jabba Hutt in a reference, but I think that the box office of Solo is a complicated. It's almost another podcast. They marketed it weird. It was a film that just wasn't enticing to people. There was some fan backlash coming from The Last Jedi. I think that's overrated how much that is, but it certainly does exist. I won't deny that. And also, they just didn't use the actor. Like, I remember I saw it, and I'm watching it, and I'm going, this guy's fantastic. And I never would have known this from any of the trailers, any of them. Mm-hmm. And I thought he was great. So, Chris, what do you think? What do you think was the problem with Solo, the box office?
No. I'm asking if Vader was in part of the marketing, if he was in the movie.
So, right. Would it have helped the box office? Yeah. Right. That's what you're asking.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't. I definitely think, and I understand with Rogue One, it was a huge part of the marketing, and probably a huge part of why that movie, I guess, overperformed at the box office.
Yeah.
I would have actually kind of been annoyed if they had gone that route again, especially with Solo, because Solo and Vader, in a weird way to me, like there's never been that connection. I think it would have just seemed overly forced and weird. Like, I even thought Maul was overly forced and weird coming in at the end, because I was like, well, I don't know how that relationship is going to work out necessarily. But I don't know. I don't think it would have made a huge difference. I think you can only play that card so many times before people start to say, oh, okay, yeah, they're doing the Vader card again. Like, that's their failsafe. Like, let's just throw Vader in and that somehow is going to... And I don't know how he would have tied into the story. I mean, you could seamlessly weave Vader into the Rogue One story, considering what they were building towards. I don't know how you seamlessly kind of weave him into Solo.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I remember when there were rumors flying around about Vader popping up in Solo, I thought to myself, okay, maybe it's, you know, their big job, right? And they're stealing hyperfuel and they're stealing it from the Empire. And he comes in to oversee what the hell's going on over here. And it's just a quick, you know, because he's the enforcer, right? He's the Empire's enforcer.
Yep.
And that would have made sense to me. And if he were included, I think, you know, I'm of the mind that it would have, people would have gotten a bit more excited about Solo because, of course, everyone loves Vader. But to your point, Chris, he is a very, very interesting card that I think they played heavily in Rogue One. And if I were to see an Obi-Wan Kenobi movie that plays on this point of another encounter between the two of them, between Vader and Obi-Wan, that would be them playing the card. And I agree with you. I think I would be like, man, I see what you're doing there. You're just trying to snare some of us folks to get excited about it.
What if the Obi-Wan Darth Vader stuff was cerebral? Whenever it was just them
attacking
talking,
with his minds,
just talking. You know, yeah, and really, you could even kind of do a Force Skype thing, like what's going on in the last. I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there. Do we need a lightsaber? No, I take one with Darth Maul. You know, we could implement that, but I would love to see an Obi-Wan Vader thing where he's talking to Anakin, like just one last time, just because, you know, he wasn't talking to Anakin in A Hope.
Yeah.
You know, he was talking to Vader.
That would be amazing, actually, because I actually think one of my biggest flaws that I found with the prequel trilogy was the fact that, you know, in A New Hope, we were sold on the relationship between Anakin and Obi-Wan, right? Its build up was this thought that they were these great friends, right? That's kind of how we always envisioned
and
it.
And we never got the payoff.
And then that relationship never really, like, was fully realized in the prequel trilogy,
because
of the way they chose to do the timing and the timeline of that whole thing. So it's like, and they were kind of separated a lot in the prequel trilogy.
You'd have to really dive into the Clone Wars, to get a bit of that. And that's like five
so
seasons.
It would be nice to see a movie that kind of could give us a little bit of that, like in between the prequels and A New Hope, where like Rick just said, Anakin, Obi-Wan is talking to Anakin. You know, not talking to Vader, not calling him Darth, you know, like where it's Anakin and they're talking on a certain level that we never really got a chance to see.
Yeah, that's you reference one of the mistakes in New Hope where he calls him Darth instead of Vader.
Yeah, well, I mean, the biggest complaint I have is, when the hell was he ever called Ben Kenobi? And, you know, that alone needs to be in a freaking standalone film. He needs to be Ben Kenobi.
Right.
But you know, you guys have such great insight. I love this. I can talk to you guys for hours. If I say this, and I agree with you, I think that there are a lot of things, and my two least favorite Star Wars films are Episode 1 and 2. And I don't dislike them. In fact, I will always refer to Episode 2 in a lot of ways as the most underrated film in the franchise. Not that I think it's like great, even though I love it. What I mean by that is it gets a lot of hate. Critics hated it. Fans hated it. I'm over here going, raising my hand slowly in the back of the class going, I kind of dig it. So just by contrast of how it's perceived and how I feel about it, that's why I think it's the most overrated. But the whole thing with Obi-Wan and Anakin's relationship, that was a misfire. And I think it was a big mistake to have Obi-Wan so isolated in for half the movie in The Phantom Menace.
Mm-hmm.
And then I didn't like in Attack of the Clones where he was kind of a jerk to Anakin. And I got it, but it just... However, with that said, I really think George did a really beautiful job with them and Sith.
Oh, I agree with that. That elevator scene where they're talking to one another.
Dude, it's so great. We needed a lot more of it, but at least we got it. And there was a sense of loss because of it. And like the beginning where they're going after General Grievous and whatnot and their dialogue. And I really like also when Bland and they're talking, he's like, no. You're the one that pulled me out of ever. And then there's a lot of that. And it's really, really great. And so we just didn't get enough of it. And we got it a little too late, but at least it's there. I would say that.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think Sith certainly doubled down on that relationship and sort of quickly establishing it. And then as quickly as they built it up, they destroyed it. Because one of my biggest complaints of Sith is how quickly Anakin just turns to the dark side and just drops on his knee and is like, "I'll do whatever you want."
Well,
no problem with that, but it is what it is.
I appreciate that, and I hear that a lot. If I could just say this, that needed a actor's director for that scene to be the kick in the nuts it needed. But I would push back and say it happened that fast. It really was a slow burn. It just.
What have I done?
Yeah. I can't sit here. Look, I have a theater background. I can't defend that acting in that scene. But that would be, I'd just kill me if I did that. But there is a little bit of a slow burn.
No, I mean, I agree with him not getting on the council and not being, and then getting on the council and not being given the title of master and all that stuff. I mean, his ambition becomes his ultimate downfall.
Isn't some of the best acting in the whole franchise? Ewan McGregor standing there on Mustafar.
You know,
gorgeous stuff.
Yelling down at him like, "You were my brother, you were the chosen one, yada, yada, all that good stuff." Yeah, no, yeah. I love that stuff.
We needed more of it, though. I agree.
Yeah, but again, you know, to talk more about Kenobi, even through this conversation, I mean, if there was anything that would get me excited about Kenobi. And it will never happen, so I should just leave it. But it would be an interaction of Kenobi on Tatooine with Ahsoka.
How do you know you're never going to get it?
See, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, that's the thing, right? I don't know. And I would love to see what happens there, because she's on a completely different path than most people. And I think she has more of an interesting background and sort of future to me, because, again, familiar character for me, because, again, consumer of all things Clone Wars, whatever, Rebels. But as someone who's turned their back on the Jedi Order but is still practicing the ways of the Force, which is an interesting dynamic. Which is honestly, before I saw The Last Jedi, I thought that was the direction that they were going to take Luke, as, you know, renounce the Jedi Order, but still ultimately a wielder of the Force and all of that good stuff. So, you know, Ahsoka's fold in this.
But they did. That's exactly what they did.
They did do that.
So does that mean then if they announce that they're going to be making this Obi-Wan movie and that Ahsoka plotline is going to be a central part of it, then you will be excited for an Obi-Wan movie?
I would be excited for Ahsoka, not for Obi-Wan. That's the only thing, because two things. One, I want to know more about her story, but two, that would be the first sort of real crossover in terms of medium of, you know, a character moving from a cartoon to real life, like an actual impersonation or a person. What am I trying to say here? An actual character brought to life who was a cartoon, you know what I mean? If they threw Thrawn in there, maybe, but, you know, again, just the idea of Obi-Wan, again, just it deflates it for me. It really does. And I hate saying that because I agree that there's a lot that he could be used for in terms of expanding the ideals and ideas of the Force beyond the Jedi and the things that he's learned while he's on Tatooine. All of that stuff I would love to see, but just not with him.
Just not everything you want to see, everything that he can bring, but just not with him.
Not with him, because the thing is, there's this is a complete sidestep, but you'll understand where I'm coming from if I make this analogy. My biggest issue with, outside of the fact that it's a horrible movie, with X-Men Apocalypse, okay, is that I've already seen the characters from Days of Future Past in the future. Right. And everybody's good and everybody's there. Cyclops is there. Wolverine is there. Jean Grey is there. Everyone's happy. Everyone's good. Right. At the end of Days of Future Past, they jump to Apocalypse. And I understand that there's a whole timeline thing. But what that movie told me was that nothing that happens in that movie has any weight or consequence, because I already know where all of the characters end up in the future. OK, so the world could be ending. And all that. So ultimately, it just becomes a fun ride for me on a never ending loop. And I'm just like, okay, yep, I know how this is all going to end. So, like, whoop de doo, do I just check my brain at the door? Am I going to be challenged in this movie to think differently about the characters? No, ultimately, I wasn't. So that's the problem I'm having with Kenobi, is that I'm not, my mind isn't going to change what I think of him, because I already see him as a, you know, as a benevolent character, as somebody whose purpose was to pass the ways of the Force to a new generation. And he's already done that with Luke. And maybe there was somebody along the way. I don't know. I don't know if they would go down that road. Everything else to me, again, is just like, yeah, okay, that's great. You still have, like, your main job, your main goal is to do this one thing. And I already know how that ends up.
Did you like Silence of the Lambs?
Yeah.
Did you like Red Dragon?
I
will skip Hannibal because that movie's garbage and it doesn't exist. But did you like Red Dragon?
I did.
With Ed Norton? Me too. I think Red Dragon is amazing.
Yeah, it's a prequel.
It's a prequel.
It is.
We know that, you know, we kind of know where this is all going to end up. And that's, to me, I want A New Hope to be Silence of the Lambs, and I want the Obi-Wan spinoff movie to be Red Dragon. That's the best analogy I can give.
But you've already kind of gotten it because it's in the prequels.
Well, I could say, what if I told you that the prequels were Hannibal?
No. I mean,
that's a little bit of an inconsistent analogy. But my point is this, in terms of what purpose it serves to further the story. I think that, and again, I defend the prequels on a lot of levels, but they are so fundamentally flawed also. Sith, borderline genius. If you could approve that one particular aforementioned scene about him falling to his knees, which was atrocious and quite frankly unacceptable in that film, it would be as good as Empire, right? In my view, anyway. But I just think that there is a story that we can tell about Obi-Wan that could be as compelling as how Hannibal Lecter was in Red Dragon. I think that, and even more so to an extent, and I don't want to get too much in the weeds on this analogy because it's a little bit flawed by just the nature of the films and the characters and whatever one's like pure, but I think that there is a story to be told. Now, let me ask you this. If you could boil it down and say, Lucasfilm, because I think some of your concerns are, man, this is too much of like all this retrospective nostalgia stuff. But if you knew that their agenda was to say, after 9 and Obi-Wan, we're moving completely away from the Skywalker saga and these characters, would that change your mind? Would that help you?
to quickly sum it up, no, because I already know that.
But you already know what?
No. I mean, we already know that after 9, you know, the Skywalker saga is done.
Well, when I say Skywalker saga, that if they talk about a Yoda spinoff and a Boba Fett spinoff, I don't think that stuff's off the table just yet.
I don't want any of that, but
I don't either. I'm just saying, but if they would that help you if that wasn't on the table at all?
Yeah, let me ask you,
what if Rey, okay, is really intensely tied to Obi-Wan?
She
may very well be. I'm not saying it's her granddaughter, but just obviously there's something there. That's the case?
It wouldn't surprise me because the Force is what binds all of them, right? So they're all somewhat connected to one another. Ooh, you like that answer.
Deep cut by Harris.
No, I mean, I'd say, yep, that's interesting. I don't need to know how, though, really. I don't really need to go back and fill in 19 years of this man's life.
You don't have to fill in 19 years. I'll just say, that's just my opinion. I'll say that we know more through The Last Jedi and really even The Force Awakens a little bit. We know more about Luke's exile and what he was doing with his time than we do Obi-Wan, in a sense. And to me, I think that's almost a little bit problematic because Luke was hiding after what happened with his nephew. And so there's not really a story to tell there. It just is what it is. And I love it. But with Obi-Wan, I think, again, there's some meat and potatoes to that. But that's my view.
Cool. Well, I'm not budging. You're not budging. So we are. This is what happens when what is the Joker's line there? When an immovable. What is it?
Talking about from The Dark Knight. This is what happens when an unstoppable force that's an immovable object, something like that.
Yeah.
It's a great line. Chris, may I ask you a question?
Sure.
Sir? What do you think the odds are that we get the Obi-Wan film? And really to all of us. What do you think we will?
You know, I do, actually, because I know the Solo box office is what it is, but I do think that hopefully they see those two things as separate things and they don't take the wrong message from the failures of Solo, which I think had more to do with, you know, I agree it has more to do with marketing and just maybe the wrong movie at the wrong time. A skippable movie after The Last Jedi probably wasn't the best idea. But I think, I mean, it's going to sound terrible to say it's 50-50, but you know what? I'll say it's probably, I don't want to say it's 50-50. So let's say right now it's 60-40 that I think we'll get it. Because I think that I do think that it's something that they want to. I think these are the types of stories they want to tell with these Star Wars stories, and I do think that they will do it.
I hope so. But here's my view, Chris, and tell me if you agree with this: is that if we don't get it in 2020, dead.
If yes.
Now something that's on the 2020 slate. I do think they're going to go back to one film a year. Good. I love Star Wars. We don't need two films a year. And no, this is not Marvel because more in a vacuum, especially for now, until they branch off from the Skywalker saga, right? But if we don't get it in 2020, if that when that's announced, that might not happen until April, whatever, next year in Chicago at Celebration, and that'll be very disappointing. And because I know, and I say this, I don't know him personally, obviously, but you watched interviews with him over the years, you know, Ewan McGregor wants to do it.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think there's a story to be told. I think we should all get away from what happens in comics and even Rebels and everything and look at it as just pretend for a moment that the only things that exist are these movies. That is the only thing that exists. The majority of the people. And this is not the same thing as a Batman, Superman, Avengers. The comics are not the source. The source of the films. And
I would say it's a 70-30 that we're going to get it. And there's
I say it's a 99% chance you're going to love it.
And there's a 0% chance that I actually would go to see it.
Wow.
Unless
0%?
I'm so anti Obi-Wan Kenobi, like,
what?
Yeah, they'd have to do some really, really crazy stuff in a trailer to get me hooked. And then even then, like, watching him, like, wield a lightsaber, it's going to be weird for me. It's just going to be very weird for me.
Wow, there are not many movies that there are a 0% chance I would go to see, let alone a Star Wars movie. I have no interest in it at all.
I really do. I don't know how to, like, communicate this clearer. I just don't want it. I don't want it at all.
You're acting like this is Problem Child 3 with the lead is John Ritter's son. No, I mean, it's just, man,
I want to throw a temper tantrum like my daughter. I just want to flip tables and say, no, I don't want it. Please do something more like The Last Jedi. Show me something different. Show me something that doesn't require me to call back on my nostalgia. I think they
can do it without you calling back on your nostalgia. I think that's the point. I think it could ultimately enhance it at the end of the day, but not throughout the film.
All right, let's wrap this one up.
Yeah,
then.
Rick, thank you very much for coming on the show and for taking it relatively easy on Aaron.
Yeah. No, honestly, Rick, such a pleasure to do this with you. You are our first guest on the show. There isn't anyone better or anyone else that we would have had. So thank you so much for coming on and for taking me to task on my article and my perspective on Obi-Wan.
And you know that I respect you immensely, and this is all just, it's fun banter, but I do hope they make it, and when they do, I hope you love it, and we're going to make sure you go see it. And Chris, we've never met. Thanks so much for letting me come on, man. I'm not used to being a guest much these days, so I hope I didn't try to over the show at any point. It's just, I'm used to hosting, and it was really a lot of fun to just come on here and be a guest and chat Star Wars with two passionate things.
It was a pleasure. Is there anything you'd like to plug before we get out of here?
Yeah, just, you know, follow me on Twitter at ShoeRick, ShewRick. If you like Batman on Film, we have a lot of really cool things lined up for our 20-year anniversary, which is this year. And we just did an on-camera interview with Michael Uslan. If you guys don't know who he is, just Google him. He's one of the executive producers on every Batman film from Keaton all the way to the Affleck stuff. We're very honored to have that. And I'm driving down to Houston next weekend to interview Bill Jett Ramey, founder, editor-in-chief of BOF. For that, we've got a lot of testimonial videos. We're going to be slicing that together, and it's be something very special.
That's great.
Just say also just a big thanks to Uzalin for supporting us and doing that.
Awesome. That is wild. And if you are a Batman fan and don't know who that man is, you are not a Batman fan. That's for sure.
He's pretty rad and hashtag very, very honored. So thanks.
All right. Thank you, Rick. And to everybody else, thanks for listening. You can find me at RealCLMighty on Twitter.
And you can find me at Starting Sith.
And the show is at the Fanboy Garage. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you next time.